This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 335 was recorded on August 4th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. David Hay, the man who coined the phrase greenflation, is back to join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll get an update on the greenflation trend, talk in detail about the formative global energy crisis and where it's headed, and also discuss equities and precious metals. Then we'll have an abbreviated post-game segment this week in order to accommodate travel schedules.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500. Another week of the market crawling higher. We're approaching those June highs around 4,200. What do you make of this market?
Well, it's fascinating to me, Patrick. I guess the reason for the spirited rally we had yesterday was that Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan did not immediately begin World War III. They didn't shoot down her plane, as there had been some threats associated with. So I guess that was cause for screaming celebration. Now what we've got today is literally ballistic missiles flying overhead in Taiwan, Chinese live fire drills, including fighter jets buzzing the country, really trying to intimidate the Taiwanese to punish them for allowing Nancy Pelosi's visit. Potentially, this could be the pretext for a full-scale invasion of Taiwan by China. And as a result of all that today, the market's down such a small amount that I can't make out on my chart exactly how much, just a few points. So if ever there was a case of good news, sort of good news, which is Nancy Pelosi got out of Taiwan alive, if there's ever been a case of good news helping the market a whole lot, but bad news not really taking the market down, I guess this has to be it. Ballistic missiles overhead, and we're down a few points. I think that it continues to be the case, Patrick, that this market is defying gravity. It seems to me that we really have not seen the worst of the economic news. I think the recession is not yet fully priced in. But boy, the market is definitely rallying. It seems like this is either the mother of all short squeezes or the sellers had just run out of shares to sell or something. I'll be surprised if that was really the bottom, but it seems like we just took out the 100-day moving average. We're out of obvious resistance levels. What do you make of it?
Well, you know what? I just generally think that the market was so oversold after having a very bearish six-month breakdown. And even during bear markets, there are numerous bear market rallies that ensue that last even several months in duration. I just don't see any evidence that this is anything different than a potential bear market rally. I think it's too premature to start getting overly bullish or excited about what was a very oversold market bounce. And that's where we find ourselves. Anyway, Eric, let's move on, though, to the dollar index, because over the last few days, the dollar tried to turn back up. It was above 106 for yesterday and giving a little bit of a back, but really starting to stabilize a little bit here. What's your take on the dollar?
Well, we're just a hair below 106 now at 105 spot 71 as we're speaking well before the close on Thursday. We're recording a little bit early this week. You know, I still look at it as we're basically holding approximately that 106 level. If we saw a sustained move below 104, that might tell me that a deeper correction has begun. But I think this is just a normal consolidation. I'm not too worried about it. I do think that the dollar is going to continue to be strong, and it should hurt other assets, but we'll see what happens. Certainly the stock market didn't get the memo on that one.
All right. Well, let's have a deeper conversation here on crude oil, because one of the things that we were talking about when we were talking charts last week was, you know, this trade range between 90 to 100. And well, We're at 88. We're breaking below a 200-day moving average here. It just seems like crude oil doesn't want to move at all bullishly. It's, in fact, I would argue that this is now a technical breakdown that that is going to spur on a little bit more selling. What's your take on how this is all playing out?
Well, Patrick, I think it was over a month ago now that I first said, I got a feeling that before this is over, we're going to hit the 200-day contract moving average, which is now at 88.74. I was planning to say on today's show, as I made my notes yesterday, I'm pretty sure we're going to hit it. And of course, the market beat me to the punchline on that one. We're below it now at 88.12 as I'm speaking. It will be important to see whether we can recover above 88.74 before the 230 pit close today. We're recording this show before that, so you'll have to check the closing print yourself in order to find the answer to that one. But one way or another, I don't think the selling is over. The market structure has changed, and it's really kind of interesting, the news flow that's caused that, because what happened on Wednesday, which was a real roller coaster ride of a day, was before the U.S. market even opened, OPEC announced that they were going to increase production by only a de minimis 100,000 barrels per day starting in September. Bloomberg's Javier Blas, I think, gets the comedy award for this week when he tweeted, I fear that President Biden may have consumed more barrels of oil flying Air Force One over to Jeddah and back than OPEC is going to release in extra production capacity in the month of September. And of course, that's an exaggeration, but not by much. Now, what's most interesting out of the OPEC announcement is not the 100,000 barrels, but they stressed very emphatically that they can't go any further because they have to reserve what precious little bit of spare capacity they have for an emergency. Frankly, the way I read that one, folks, is I don't think they have any spare capacity. I think they're pedaling as fast as they can already. Maybe Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates have a little bit of spare capacity, but the analysis that I've read says at 11 million barrels, which is where Saudi Arabia is going to be starting in September, yeah, in theory, they can dial up to 12 million barrels, but most analysts are saying they can't sustain that indefinitely. Maintenance requirements would get them back below that to 11 point something. So even the extra million barrels of spare capacity, which is all that seems to be left in the global market, isn't really there as far as I can tell. That seems like profoundly bullish news. Sure enough, it caused crude oil prices to skyrocket $3 higher in a matter of minutes. But you know what, Patrick? As soon as the U.S. market opened at 9 a.m., all of the sudden the selling began, took us right back down, fully retracing that entire OPEC move up before inventory even came out. Then U.S. inventory was released at 10:30 in the morning on Wednesday, reporting a 4.5 million barrel build on inventories. Not a drawdown this week, but a build. Now, in reality, it was really a 0.2 million barrel, 200,000 barrel drawdown, but it was offset by a 4.7 million barrel draw from the SPR, which made up for it, makes it look like the headline number is actually a build of 4.5 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, also building a million barrels. Gasoline building 200,000 barrels. Distillates was the only drawdown on the board, drawing down 2.4 million barrels. U.S. production remaining unchanged. Now, interestingly, normally when you get a big print like that, a big build, the algorithmic traders are programmed to react, and it's within milliseconds of the news coming out that the market reacts. We didn't see that this week, which really surprised me. There was a good 3 or 4 minutes of no reaction at all in prices before the selling resumed, and boy, did it resume in earnest once it got going. That took us down to retest the July 14th lows, but completely different tape action than what happened on July 14th. On July 14th, the market had sold off during the European session, probably got to the point of hitting some stop losses for some big funds. As soon as the U.S. opened, it was sell, 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 sell. Until 10 o'clock in the morning, the smart money saw that the selling had finished, and they jumped in and bought like crazy. By the time we got to the 2:30 close, it was a reversal day. We had retraced to the upside all the way back, not only the U.S. session losses, but we fully retraced the Europe session losses and ended up with a reversal candle on the day. The opposite of that happened on Wednesday. We saw sell, sell, sell all the way down to closing at the 2:30 pick close, almost on the low print of the day. A very, very weak attempt to recover just a dollar or so on the European session overnight. As soon as we got, even before the U.S. opened, around 6 or 7 in the morning New York time, the selling resumed and took us well below the 200-day contract moving average, which is 88.74, all the way down to 87.60-ish or so. Looks like we're trying to bounce now. It'll be very interesting to see if we can get above that 88.74 200-day, but I can tell already from this tape action, we're not seeing the exuberant everybody piles in and, okay, the bottom's in, let's buy this thing hand over fist the way we saw on the 14th of July. This is maybe it's going to try to bounce a little bit. It'll be interesting to see whether it can get back above that number before the close. So there's clearly a very strong impetus here, despite the fact that we've got big geopolitical escalations, which normally help the price of crude oil, despite the OPEC news. Everybody's focused, I think, on worsening economic data and expectations of a deeper recession. So I think there probably is a lot more selling to come. It's because of expectations that demand is going to collapse. EIA reporting that there's much lower gasoline demand. That's probably one of the big drivers for the bearish side of this. Does that mean that Adam Rosenzweig and I get egg on our faces and we were totally wrong about the energy crisis that we think already began? I say no, absolutely not. With the strongest conviction I've ever had in my career, I think we are at the early stages of a multi-year energy crisis. But it looks like demand destruction is going to hide that from most people for it could be several more months or as long as it takes for this recession to play out. And I won't be surprised if we see considerably lower prices from here before this is over. Now, separately, we don't have time to get into it today. Maybe we can do a post-game segment on this in the future. Backwardation has collapsed completely in the crude oil term structure. Normally, that's an extremely bearish sign, and the fact that it has collapsed, I think, has probably contributed to this selling. The thing is, did it collapse for organic reasons, or did it collapse because everybody is front-running the expected buying of long-dated futures at the back of the curve, which is the White House policy that was announced, is how they're going to handle this SPR draw of another 20 million barrels. So what is that front-running doing to artificially collapse the term structure and distort that signal? That's a really difficult question. We don't have time for it in the market wrap. Maybe at some point we'll cover that in a post-game segment.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because on Tuesday, it made a good push right up to 1800, where the May lows were and was a key fib level. And gold looked like yesterday was rolling right over. And then here we are today with another solid push to a week high, and we're holding above 1800. It just seems like suddenly gold is getting bid. What's your take on gold? Do you think that this could be a turn?
Well, that's interesting, Patrick. I almost have an opposite perspective than you do. The way I see this is gold is, among other things, supposed to be a geopolitical conflict hedge. You know, when wars start, gold tends to spike up. We literally have China responding to their disapproval of Nancy Pelosi's visit of Taiwan, with fighter jets buzzing Taiwan, live missiles being fired over Taiwan. China is trying to send a signal that could be the pretext for a full-scale invasion of Taiwan, and gold has only moved a few bucks. I would have said almost the opposite of what you did, which is I would expect gold to get a much bigger bid, considering what to me is a pretty big deal geopolitically. I guess I see both the Russia conflict and the China-Taiwan conflict as having the potential to grow into a major conflict between global superpowers, United States versus Russia and China, not just the little proxy wars that we're seeing so far. I guess the rest of the market doesn't see it that way, and maybe that's why gold's not catching a bigger bid than I would have expected. But I think this is happening because of these geopolitical events. What I want to see is, can gold continue this rally when it's not being fueled by that news? Because as you said, it looked like gold was starting to roll over for the last couple of days. Well, then you got missiles flying this morning, and that's helped to put a bid under it. Will it last? That's the question on my mind.
Well, you know, if I was to push back on your pushback, one thing to consider is that typically while your view that gold would typically respond to that is correct, often that would also, though, have sent the intermarkets completely into a panic mode. Usually you'd have big currency moves, big moves in oil markets, which is sort of happening, but you would also have seen, a lot of moves in bonds and interest rates and other variables. And really, the market's been very calm. And so gold's response has been calm, but really so has the whole intermarket landscape. So I don't know. It's all relative. But nonetheless, let's touch on that 10-year treasury yield, which, obviously the last month has seen us break down, or at least the last 2 weeks has seen us break down below 3%. We got almost down to 2.5% before earlier this week, a little bit of a bounce back. I mean, we're at 270, still far from the 3% level. But it really looks like interest rates have put in some at least short-term top and maybe even an intermediate level high. What's your take on interest rate trends?
Well, Patrick, as I've said for several weeks, I really don't have a directional call or any strong conviction of where we're headed. I'm looking at this more of a barometer to tell me what's going on. Seems like inflation concerns are starting to come out of the system. Maybe inflation is about to come under control. I'm skeptical. We'll see what happens. But certainly all that fear that was driving interest rates well above 3% seems to have come out of the system. Maybe inflation really has peaked. We'll see what happens.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is David Hay. Eric, why did we get David back on the show this week?
You know, David is the guy who coined the phrase greenflation, which he explained in his last interview on Macro Voices. And I just think that it was incredibly prescient of him to notice that trend, because a lot of what we're seeing and what President Biden has even acknowledged in his messaging, he's saying, look, don't think about this as inflation. Think about it as just the expense that we have to pay for a very important and necessary transition to a climate-sensitive green economy. Well, at least finally, we're admitting that this stuff doesn't come free. And if you want to have these climate-driven priorities, it's going to cost something. So now as we see interest rates seemingly coming back down under control, as we just talked about in the market wrap, and as we see people calling a peak in inflation, saying, okay, the worst is over, it's all going to get better from here, I wanted to get an update from the guy who coined the phrase greenflation and see where he sees this is headed, what he thinks is coming next.
Well, Eric's interview with David Hay is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is David Hay, Chief Co-Investment Officer for Evergreen GavCal and the founder of the Haymaker social media site. David prepared a slide deck to accompany this week's interview. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. David, it's great to have you back. I want to credit you for being the guy who told our listeners first about what you called greenflation, the idea that, hey, as much as the climate agenda and so forth, these are all noble goals, things we ought to do to make the planet a better place, it doesn't come for free, and you have to consider that these policy initiatives mean that it will introduce inflation into the economy. Well, boy, you sure got that one right. So congratulations on that call. I'd like to ask you for an update. You know, you definitely called this one. How has this gone? I wasn't expecting President Biden to essentially say the same thing when he told everybody it's not a recession, it's a transition, and it's a cost of getting to green energy. How has this played out compared to what you expected, and what do you see next for this greenflation story?
Well, first of all, Eric, it's great to be back on. We had a really lively discussion last time. I went back and I listened to it, and you and I made some pretty good calls at that point. In fact, both of us were very skeptical that energy prices would stay suppressed, particularly as we got deeper and deeper into what I would call the great green energy transition, to use that transition word again. And it's pretty remarkable, really, what's happened. I mean, it was, if you remember, that one of the big focus points in that discussion, which I think was October 28th of last year, was what was already a serious energy crisis in Europe. Oil and gas prices, electricity prices were exploding already at that point. But since we talked, actually, electricity prices in France are up another 500%, and in Germany, they're up 300%. I just don't think Americans realize, have any clue as to how bad it is over there. And a lot of this started way before Putin put on his blitz, way before those tanks ever crossed the Ukrainian border. So this is a problem that's been festering for a long time.
Well, David, when you talk about lively discussions, I know you're a regular listener to the show, so I'm sure you heard my interview with Adam Rosenzweig last week. I'd love to get your reactions to that. Is there anything you disagree with Adam on, and how do you see things compared to the way he described the energy situation?
It was terrific, and I'm a big fan of Adam's. I read their research routinely and have for years. In fact, that's one of the reasons I was so convinced that energy was a screaming buy last October, even as far back as 2020. And his one of the points that he made in your recent podcast that I thought was quite fascinating, something I'd picked up on, is this Freeport LNG outage, which is a very big deal because Europe, and we've already talked about how severe their energy shortage is over there, so they desperately need U.S. LNG. And a few months ago, there was an explosion at the Freeport LNG export facility in Texas, and that took off about 2% of U.S. exports to Europe. So we export about 10 billion cubic feet a day. We produce about 90. So it's significant. It's about 11% of total U.S. production that's now being directed to Europe. And again, those guys need it very much. And it's almost life and death for them. And so when that was taken off, you would have thought there would have been a glut of natural gas in the United States, at least until that plant came back online, because you weren't getting it out to Europe at the same rate that you were before the explosion. As he pointed out, what's shocking is that we're actually seeing inventories, natural gas inventories, continue to contract in the United States, very different than what the expectations were when that plant first came offline. So it is just remarkable to think about where gas is trading in Europe right now. It's $58 per MMBTU, which is million British thermal units. But as I often say, and this is a pretty loose analogy, it's kind of like a gallon of gas. I mean, usually natural gas in the United States kind of trades somewhere around a gallon of gas, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less. So imagine it would be like $58 gasoline that they've got over there. And what's interesting, and this is actually a lead into a very important point, because I also noticed in your back and forth with Adam that you were expressing concerns that perhaps the U.S. crude oil market could be glutted, or even the global crude oil market might be in a glut situation because of demand destruction caused by a recession. And that's a whole other topic that I know we're going to get to, the economy and are we in recession, will be in recession. But I want to make the point to you that even if we do go into a global recession, I believe there will be virtually no demand destruction of crude. And the reason is fuel switching. So what you're starting to see in Europe is something I've been actually talking about for a couple of months and writing about, which is that the European companies and utilities, the big companies like their chemical companies, their petrochemical companies that are being threatened with shutting down because they can't get natural gas for their feedstock. But what the utilities are beginning to do, and even some of the large companies that generate their own power, is they're now saying they're going to switch over from burning coal or natural gas, because that's where the traditional fuel switching has been, right? Between coal and natural gas, depending on which is cheaper. Now, oil is so much less expensive than either natural gas or coal in Europe, they're going to burn oil. So this is a big, big deal. And right now, I think the most recent projection I saw was that it would be an increase of about 800,000 barrels per day, almost 1 million barrels per day by the European industrial base starting to burn oil, and again, particularly utilities, because you can generate power with coal, natural gas, or oil, or in some cases, nuclear. And then there's, of course, the burning of wood pellets. We may want to talk about that. That's one of the most scandalous things that's going on, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole quite yet. But if you look at oil on an MMBTU equivalent basis, so $100 oil is equivalent to about 5.8 MMBTUs per barrel. So if you do the math, what it really boils down to is we're talking about $18 equivalent gas. Now, remember, it's 58. So they can buy oil and they can get natural gas at a price equivalent of about $18. And they're going to be buying that every single spare barrel of oil that's out there. Europe will suck in my opinion. And it's also a heck of a lot easier to ship. As you know, LNG is tricky. You got to freeze it down to 270 degrees minus Fahrenheit. And then once you get it over to Europe, you've got to have a regasification facility. You've got to be able to deliver it to the various places where they need it, which typically isn't Germany. They're trying to put in floating regasification units on a overnight rush basis. But oil is a much easier commodity to ship and much cheaper. So I think that's something that I really haven't heard hardly anybody talk about. I've heard it a little bit from Cornerstone Analytics, Mike Roth, and I heard a little bit from Marshall Adkins at Ray J. But for the most part, that's just off people's radar. And I think it's a big deal. We've never gone into a recession with a major energy consumer unbelievably short of energy. So that's my little twist on that.
I want to push back on that one. And I'm just doing this off the cuff here because I hadn't thought about this. But what strikes me...
something you hadn't thought about. That's amazing.
Well, what strikes me about this, I get the math on the energy equivalent, but the question that really hits me is, okay, if I think about the politics, particularly of Europe, what you're saying is somebody's got to go and say, we've got to make a very significant capital expenditure to put new equipment in because we're going to switch from burning natural gas as a fossil fuel to burning crude oil. It's not crude oil, but they're going to burn something that is produced directly from crude oil as opposed to directly from natural gas. They're going to burn heating oil or something that comes from crude oil. Well, wait a minute. How do you justify the capital expenditure of the changeover of equipment? Because the burners that are burning natural gas don't just burn fuel oil. You got to buy a new furnace or a new machine, whatever it is that's consuming that energy. How do you justify new CapEx on something that burns crude oil or a crude oil derivative in the political environment that exists in Europe? It sounds to me like a hard sell because look at what's going on in Germany. Despite this crazy crisis, they had announced that they were going to take their remaining three nuclear plants offline at the end of this year because of a misplaced belief that nuclear is anti-green, which according to the green movement, they think it's not a sustainable energy source or it's not green. If you can't keep your nuclear plant running, which doesn't require switching any equipment over, how do you justify buying and installing new equipment to burn a fuel which you're supposedly committed to phasing out?
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And I would say that forget my opinion and my whatever I'm going to say beyond this first point, which is they're already doing it. So there, if you track, you can go to the, go online and look at these large companies in Europe, but again, including utilities that are already making this switchover. So they're doing it. So obviously they feel it's justifiable. I would go one step further and say they really have no choice. I mean, it's almost like whatever the cost, because equipment cost relative to the price differential between oil and natural gas is so immense. And also, too, realize that fuel switching has gone on for decades. It's just typically between natural gas and coal. So it's not that difficult. I would actually argue it's easier to switch from natural gas to oil because you're going liquid to gas, almost quasi-liquid versus coal. But it's just not really been done. And why hasn't it been done until recently? And again, it's happening already, so it's not conjecture. But in the past, nobody really thought about it because, as you know, for years and years and years, decades, natural gas was a lot cheaper than oil. Coal was a lot cheaper than oil. Coal was usually the cheapest of all, although there were times when natural gas crashed in price and it became more attractive than coal. And it's certainly more attractive from an environmental standpoint. It burns much cleaner, as you know. So it's happening. And I just don't think most people have focused on that yet. And there's still, your concerns are shared by a lot of folks. Every time you see, like yesterday, there was bad economic data out of China. And what happens to the oil market? It goes down, $4.50 a barrel. That's a big one-day drop. So every time there's weakness, like when you might remember right after we just had our chat, about 3 weeks later, the whole Omicron thing hit the scene and oil stocks, energy stocks just got crushed right after Thanksgiving. And every one of these has been a great buying opportunity because there is this underlying tightness that we have in the commodity market. And, you know, you're very skookum, very aware of what's going on in the oil market. So you're tracking what's happening here with this announcement where the Biden administration is going to try to narrow the spread to get to buy forward futures to try to bring up the kind of solve that extreme backwardation situation that we've had, or at least partially eliminate that. And they have. You're well aware, it's come down pretty significantly. But, you know, this just is another manipulation of the oil market. The first one, of course, is the release of the SPR, which is 1 million barrels a day. So that's a big deal. That's a lot of oil. It's about 1% of the market. And they're going to run out of that at some point this fall. So you're going to have that flipping. So there's 1 million barrels a day of reduced supply. Then you're going to have China reopening, which is always a, you know, it's kind of a Greek farce in a way, or tragedy, that they go through this. It looks like they're out of the woods and then they're back in the woods. Their zero COVID policy has been real problematic in that regard. But then you're going to have this fuel switching, which I think will be at least 1 million barrels a day. So you're looking at about a 4 million a barrel a day swing that is going to use up any demand destruction that occurs. And that would be to go down more than 4 million barrels a day would have to be just a horrific global economy, which I guess we could get, but I think that's unlikely.
Well, that's where maybe we disagree a little bit. And I'm with you. What I've been saying for months now is I thought that what we were going to see was the market needed to price in a recession, which meant that the flow of crude oil futures, all the speculative open interest, would come out of the market. Now, that's already happened. And I thought once the speculative open interest was out of the crude oil market and we stabilized in terms of where the specs were on the open interest charts, on the commitment of traders reports, I thought that we would then see a resumption of the bull market in crude oil prices. And what I've realized is, you know, there's plenty of scope considering that central banks all around the world overstimulated through the pandemic crisis. There's plenty of room for a really, really deep global recession, which causes a whole lot of demand destruction, and it's the whole planet. So, you know, I'm absolutely convinced of the basic thesis that what happens here is oil prices go down as we price in the recession, then eventually they start going up again. But frankly, I've opened my mind to the possibility of another $20 downside on oil prices before that resumption of the uptrend occurs. And the reason I say that is I think that this coming global recession, not just U.S., could be a lot deeper and longer than most people think.
Well, I certainly agree with you when it comes to Europe. Europe, I just don't see how they avoid a nasty recession. Just so many things going against it, but primarily energy. I mean, if you got a major drop in energy prices, that might throw them a lifeline. I just don't think you're going to get that, at least when it comes to crude oil. I mean, I do think their natural gas prices at $58 per MMBTU is just, that's just off the charts. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that come down fairly drastically, but probably not to that $18 equivalent on oil. So I do think you've got a bid there that's going to be surprisingly persistent. And then you got to look at China. I mean, China's already gone through a slowdown. So I'd say that at some point, you know, they've just got to live with COVID and make the decision that they're going to get back to life as normal. I mean, you look at the experience of Sweden and Norway and how they have behaved in a much less panicky way with regards to COVID. And they've had really a pretty comparable experience to most other parts of the world. And in many cases, way better than, say, the Northeast United States in terms of death rate per million. I think this panic that we've been in for the last, more than 2 years over COVID is probably behind us. And I think eventually China will adopt that kind of a mindset too. And their demand's down about 2 million barrels a day. So them coming back to normal is a very big deal. Then you got India, which has got, 1.4 billion people. And that's they're definitely a major user of oil, a growing user of oil. So I think there's some real lasting demand drivers, but then look at supply. And if you look at the supply right now in the United States, I mean, we're way below where we, you know, the normal level, the 7-year average. It's something like over 200 million barrels below normal right now. So we've got very tight inventories. And so, you know, you could be right. Anything's possible when it comes to the financial markets. And to your point, when you look at the level of financialization of trading of the crude oil market, you probably know the stat better than I do, but I believe it's about 28 to 1. In other words, about 28 times as much paper trading in the oil market versus the physical market. And that's, in most commodities, it's more like 4 or 5 times. So what the financial markets decide to do, and a lot of these are, of course, programmed by algorithms, and they see recession, you know, in the beige book, and the recession readings in the Fed's beige book are just off the charts. So that naturally puts a lot of financial selling pressure on. But as you point out, a lot of that's played out. And the lowest they were able to get oil prices was to about $90 a barrel, and then it had a nice rebound. So I think this, I mean, the assumption is that in a recession, oil prices go down. The other assumption is in a recession, interest rates go down. I'm not sure either one of those is going to happen this time, but that's, of course, a whole different subject when you talk about interest rates.
Well, and I think it's important, too, as we go back to the fuel switching idea, as you point out, there could be profound differences between the company that is consuming fuel oil versus the company that's consuming natural gas for the reasons that you described. But at the end of the day, if you aggregate the global supply that's available of both natural gas and of crude oil, and you include all of the spare capacity, that's the ability for producers to make more than they're making now by, you know, turning up the dials and producing as much as they can, it's still not enough to return the global economy to pre-pandemic normal. We can't get there from here, and we've made policy mistakes that are going to prevent us from getting there for years to come. So although that pain is going to be concentrated depending on what kind of fuel you're burning, at the end of the day, the big picture is we don't have enough energy to get the world back to where we were. And this whole idea that it's a green transition and it's all a good thing, you know, I think this is a case of trying to phase out the old before the replacement was phased in. It's all a great idea, but we don't have the new green energy or enough of it to run the global economy. We still need fossil fuels, and we're disfavoring any new investment in fossil fuels or in petroleum refining capacity, and we've gotten ourselves into a really, really difficult position here. David, now that we've seen the rally in energy prices that you and I both predicted back in October when we last spoke, that definitely came true. Now we've also seen the steep correction that I've described on the podcast since before it started, which was at some point we had to price in the coming recession. Seems like it's mostly priced in or almost completely priced in, or maybe it's got more pricing in to go. But at some point, though, it gets fully priced in. At that point, do you see a sharp resumption in energy prices, or do we just muddle along and the already high energy prices stifle the economy to the point where we don't get the growth that brings the demand back online? How does this play out from here?
Well, I wish I knew. Absolutely. I have some inclinations, and one of my inclinations is that oil prices are going to have another spike up. And one thing, as we were going back and forth, we didn't really talk about was Russia and how much Russian oil is going to come off the market. And so far, they've been pretty clever about getting around the sanctions. But I do think there's going to be a loss of Russian production, demand and supply. So it's, if you're a buyer of Russian crude, obviously a lot of countries won't do that. Other countries such as India say, sure, sign me up, I'll take that cheap crude. But there's difficulties in getting it to market. You know, the Russian energy complex was really set up to send energy west to Europe through the pipelines, not really as well set up to get it on ships, and they certainly can, but it's obviously much more difficult and expensive and time-consuming to put it on a ship and sail it all the way around, say, to India versus piping it to Eastern and Western Europe. So that's another issue. I mean, originally the IEA was saying that Russia was going to be down 4 million barrels in production, or at least in terms of demand for that production, and that's really not turned out that way. But there is going to be a loss, and you know, guessing how much that is, I would say probably 1 million to 2 million barrels, but that's just another supportive factor for pricing. But I think we should also give ourselves a little pat on the back, because I did go back and I made a note of what the S&P had done from that time where we had our last chat, which is it's down 10%, the NASDAQ's down 17%, the energy ETF, XLE, is up 36%, even the midstream is up 15%, so those are huge deltas. And as you know, when we were both positive on energy back at that time, that was a very non-consensus view. There were so many people in our business that felt that energy was uninvestable, and it turned out that was just a horrible decision. And even with the big rally, and you know, it's what, 4% of the S&P, so it's still a very, very small percentage of the S&P. And the other thing, to your point about, watch out for a correction, there's been a brutal correction, much more so than the price of oil, with a lot of the energy names down 20, 30, even 50% from early June. So it was, like a vicious bear market that came out of nowhere. So I think you've got a great setup. There's some of these companies that are trading with 25% free cash flow yields, trading at 3 and 4 times earnings. And those earnings are based, as you know, on that forward curve. So when analysts set their earnings estimates for 2024, they're looking at where's the futures market in 2024. Well, even though the backwardation, which is, to be clear, the difference between the spot price and the, let's say, the 2-year out price, typically the spot price is at a discount, which would be contango, the normal structure. Backwardation is where the spot price is above. In this case, it's $20 a barrel above. And you and I both said one of the best plays back in late October was to buy the longer dated futures contracts. And boy, those worked really well. And I still think they're a great buy. But the point is that because earnings estimates are based on those futures contracts, there's that undervaluation kind of built in as well. So I continue to think energy equities are going to be very strong performers over the next year or two.
David, that buying opportunity you're describing is presented visually on slide 1. What's going on in this chart?
So basically, the red or pink dotted line is showing you where the energy index is trading. So you can see the huge move that happened after we had our first discussion.
Energy index means the stocks, energy stocks, exactly. As opposed to the actual crude oil itself.
Correct, like XLE, the energy stock ETF. And so you can see the big rise, but you can also see this big decline that I mentioned here earlier. But what is really showing between the pink line and the green line is that based upon where even the 2-year out futures contract is trading, which is right now about 80, that is well below, basically energy equities would need to trade up to about to a little over 800 on the index to be equivalent to where the 2-year futures oil contract is. And obviously it's bouncing around a little bit. So on this chart, it was 75, I think. Yeah, it's still about where it is right now. So the point is that just to be where even the undervalued futures oil contract is, these energy equities would need to appreciate significantly, basically from roughly 500 to roughly 800. So that's about a 60% undervaluation. That's a big move.
So you think the real buying opportunity is in the stocks, which are more discounted than the price of the energy itself is?
Correct.
Now, David, let's put this in context, because we're looking at this chart, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners would look at this and say, boy, it's sold off. There's a dip there. But before I buy that dip, it's up a heck of a lot since the 1st of May. I think it's really important to put in context where we are in this story, which is all summer long, we have been drawing down 1 million barrels a day from the SPR. Now, I think in theory, the promise is that we would be rebuilding 1 million barrels a day, or maybe they're not going to put it back as fast as they took it out. So maybe it's 500,000 barrels a day. But let's say we were getting a benefit of 1 million barrels a day, and we're supposedly going to pay back 500,000 barrels a day. That means there's 1.5 million barrels a day that's not going to be there as we go in the other direction from draining down the SPR to supposedly refilling the SPR. Now, personally, my prediction is the Biden administration is not really going to follow through and actually refill the SPR and replace all the oil that they sucked out of it over the last however many months it's been. But assuming that were to happen, or even if it didn't, we still are losing the benefit of that 1 million barrels a day, and I'm not sure where it's going to come from. It's not like anybody is dramatically increasing production. We're recording this interview on Tuesday morning, so we don't have the announcement from OPEC Plus, which will be out by the time the interview airs, but I'm pretty confident they're not going to be increasing by 1.5 million barrels a day to allow room to stop drawing down the SPR and start replenishing it. So that would suggest that if they just stop drawing down the SPR, which has been promised supposedly now, just pure coincidence to coincide with election season in November, after election season is over, come 1st of November, there should be the impetus for maybe another move up in energy prices. And of course, markets tend to see these things coming and move before that. So is it early to buy this dip, or is it really a ripe time to buy this dip?
Well, it was a very ripe time a few weeks ago, but as you know, that the kind of the whole real asset class area has been in rebound mode. But still, the amount of damage that was done from basically early June to early July was pretty epic, and there's only been a partial recovery. I mean, it's been a pretty healthy bounce back, so it might make sense to just nibble a little bit for people that are underweight or not exposed to energy at all, but which is by definition almost everybody, because, you know, as you're well aware, the world has gone so much toward indexing, and indexing by definition has like a 4% exposure to energy. So in my view, that's way too low in a world that is chronically short of energy and fossil fuels in particular. So yes, I think you would buy a little bit here, but buy more aggressively in any pullback. I mean, if we look at chart two, it shows what you were describing, which is this incredibly low level of oil in the United States. And this is actually a global phenomenon. It's not just the United States that has got extremely low crude oil inventories. And as you point out, it's despite all this oil that's been released from the SPR, 1 million barrels a day. That's really a significant number. And it's going to stop sooner or later. And you did make a good point, too, that I really didn't, which is at some point it's going to go the other way. It needs to be replenished. Now, how soon they replenish it, you know, who knows? That is, I agree with you, much more of a political decision than a real decision, but it's getting dangerously low. So I think it's just a matter of time. I guess by 2024, probably more likely that you'd start to see it being replenished in a fairly aggressive way. But regardless, inventories are super low, and these inventories at this level indicate prices much higher than where we are currently. Now, if we look at slide three, you kind of touched on this before, but just this impracticality of what's being attempted in the great green energy transition, and yet hydrocarbons still dominate the global energy mix, which is what slide three shows. And interestingly, it's not really the developed world that has been behind that. It's the developing world, countries like China, India, Indonesia. So many of the developing countries have been relatively low hydrocarbon users, and now they're really ramping up. And one of the areas where the U.S. energy industry is doing a great thing is by exporting propane, where in a lot of the developing world, they don't have any, you know, you can't flip a switch and turn on the gas or the lights. It's basically a wood burning, or it's even dung burning, and usually with very poor ventilation. I might have touched on this last time, but the World Health Organization estimates 2 to 3 million people die every year from breathing poor air from their own homes, within their own homes. So getting cleaner burning fossil fuels to them is a humanitarian favor that we're starting to do for the rest of the world.
Now, let's just play devil's advocate here. You know that I passionately agree with you. I think that we are in the very early stages of a global energy crisis, which is going to be crippling to the global economy, that's going to last the rest of the decade. But there would be people on the other side of this argument who would say, look, you guys are totally missing the point. The reason President Biden is talking about this great transition, the reason the World Economic Forum is talking about this, is that wind and solar, that's a tiny little percentage at the top of your chart, is about to take over, baby. We're not going to need all that oil and gas, because really soon now we're going to be developing a huge amount of wind and solar. That's the whole transition. You guys are missing the story. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd say that there's very little doubt that wind and solar will continue to grow rapidly, though I do think the growth rate is likely to slow. And part of the reason why I think the growth rate is likely to slow is that a lot of these essential ingredients, if you will, are very expensive and in short supply. Lithium is, of course, one of the most important of all the green energy sources or resources, and it's gone up 1,000% over the last few years. And you're starting to see, you know, extreme jumps in pricing for other critical elements. I think copper is one that's, even though copper prices are down right now because of economic fears, but right now there's 24 million tons of copper that's consumed per year. Only about 1.5 million tons of that go into green areas. And that is going to go up significantly. S&P's got it at 50 million tons of total demand for copper by 2035. I think Goldman Sachs has got it at 30 million tons. And most of that increase driven by green energy needs. So what's that going to do to the price of copper? I know the folks at Goldman Sachs, Jeff Currie's team, they think copper is going to go absolutely parabolic at some point, but some of these already have. So that's one of the big problems, is that there's this assumption that you'll always have cheap materials for renewables. I don't think that's going to be true. And actually, the way things are trending, it's not true even right now.
Well, I think it's important to consider that one of the most important materials, if you want to call it a material, that goes into any of these energy sources is capital. And, you know, look, let's look at this from the investor's perspective. You and I can agree that the world is about to face a really serious problem, which all has to do with fossil fuels and not having enough of them. We're not going to be able to get through this transition because we've underinvested in new exploration and production capacity. But wait a minute. For an investor looking at this, you could try to invest in solving that very important old problem, which is not a long-term strategic play. Or you can get in on the ground floor. Look at how tiny the wind and solar is at the top of your chart here on page 3. That has to take over eventually so that it's most of the chart. And world leaders are very clearly committed and dedicated to that. They're providing governmental subsidies to help the investments that are made in those sectors to grow. If I'm an investor, why would I want to invest in the old stuff when I can invest in the future, where the green energy is clearly where we're headed longer term? I would be, I don't know about you, but I'm certainly happy to acknowledge that my concerns about fossil fuels, I'm not saying it's the right strategic long-term solution. I agree that renewables are the future. But what are we going to do if all the smart people put their investments in the long-term future and nobody's investing in solving this problem that we have right now with oil and gas? I think that's the real conundrum.
Well, I think you're precisely right, but I think that's, for a contrarian, that's actually really good news. I mean, you want to be where most people are not, where there's underinvestment. You want to avoid overinvestment. You want to invest, as I often quote Tony Deaton, Grant Williams' Yoda, if you will, that you want to invest in scarcity. So where is scarcity? Scarcity is ironically in not only fossil fuels, but in things like copper, where it's not just capital starvation. You made that excellent point, which I didn't, about energy, that there's been this absolute cliff dive when it comes to investing in new oil and gas production. And it's partially because of ESG. It's partially because there's been two oil busts. It's partially because there's tremendous pressure on Wall Street not to reinvest, but to buy back shares and pay out dividends. So you've got that really across the commodity complex. And many of these commodities are essential for the great green energy transition, like copper. So, I mean, that's another way to approach it, Eric, is to say, well, look, I believe it's going to happen. And I do. I think we're going to have millions of new EVs on the road coming up over the next 4 or 5 years. Now, how the grid's going to be able to handle that, that's another big question. Now, what's going to happen to the price of those batteries? Because so many things, even solar panels, are starting to go up in price instead of down in price. So that's an issue. You've also got the fact that wind and solar are intermittent. And oftentimes they have to be backed up by things like natural gas plants. And also a lot of the developing world look at renewables much more skeptically than we do. There's been some pretty bad outcomes with countries that have really tried to aggressively go only renewable. So there's just going to be this ongoing demand from the developing world. And there's a lot more folks there than there are in the developed world. So that's the other thing I would point out, too, is that when you think about who controls most of these critical materials for the great green energy transition, almost all roads lead to China. And just look at the problem that Europe has for being heavily energy dependent on Russia. So does the rest of the West really want to, and Europe for that matter, make that same mistake instead of jumping from the Russian frying pan into the Chinese fire in that regard? It doesn't get much press, but I think it's extremely dangerous for us to be trying to power the Western world on renewables, which have their intermittency issues, but they also have this scarcity problem and so much of it controlled by China. You probably know off the top of your head, I think it's something like 95% of rare earth minerals are controlled by China, one way or the other, either in terms of the actual source of the processing.
Yeah, it's ironic that if I understand this correctly, one of the main reasons for that is that China has more lax environmental controls. And although the energy that we're talking about, you know, wind turbines are obviously a very green, renewable, you know, good feeling environmental kind of thing, the rare earth elements that are needed to make the magnets inside the motors or the turbine generators for those things, as I understand it, it's a very ugly mining process that's not mm-hmm. environmentally friendly at all. China's willing to do it and take the environmental risks that I don't think you can compete with China elsewhere, because most other jurisdictions, as I understand it, would not tolerate the environmental impact of that kind of mining. I don't know very much about it, but boy, it's very interesting that this on the day that we're recording this interview, just a couple of hours before we began recording, Nancy Pelosi landed in Taipei, first time in 25 years that a senior U.S. government official has visited Taiwan, and already the Chinese military has pledged to conduct military responses, and they haven't said what that's going to be yet. So we have escalating geopolitical tension with China at a time when our green energy transition is very much dependent on those rare earth elements that come mostly from China.
You're right. Yeah, that's another bizarre geopolitical move as far as her visit at this point in time. But I guess they say it is what it is.
You know, something else that really struck me, gold, which you have on page 4 of the chart deck, is supposed to be, at least some people think, it's a geopolitical hedge. So when things get dicey in the geopolitical world, the price of gold goes up. Gold is absolutely flat on the day that Nancy Pelosi landed in Taipei and China vowed military response. And meanwhile, we have another conflict with another nuclear superpower. What's going on with gold here? And how come it's not, I guess in you're showing on the chart here that in US dollar terms, it's maybe not doing that great, but in other currencies, it is. Where do you see gold going from here?
Well, I'm not as bullish on gold as I am on energy and other commodities that get consumed and are, you know, really vital to the operation of the world. The world could get by without gold, although it never will. It's, I think, one of the reasons why gold has got a persistent bid is because foreign central banks are gradually accumulating gold and kind of erratically divesting themselves of treasuries. And of course, the whole weaponization of the U.S. dollar that happened with the sanctions due to the invasion of Ukraine makes foreign central banks even more hesitant to hold U.S. dollars or treasuries. But speaking of the U.S. dollar, that's what's really been behind this correction in the price of gold, because gold and other, as we see in chart 4 and other currencies, it's actually made new highs. So if you're a Japanese investor, you're probably pretty happy with your gold holdings. But for the U.S., where we kind of denominate everything in dollars, not so hot. And of course, the gold mining stocks have been even worse. They've been enduring a really serious correction, though they had a great move earlier in the year. They were up like 23-25%. In the first quarter or during the first quarter when the market was down.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. No, you had to take some profits there, which we did. And that's I guess that's maybe what we do differently than some typical gold-oriented folks, because we do like the gold story long-term, because I do think we're going through this kind of gradual death of fiat currencies, and having gold and silver in your portfolio is, I think, it's one of the best hedges against that kind of massive debasement. But that's not probably right around the corner, of course. But you get these powerful up moves, particularly in the miners, and we don't get out, but we take significant profits. I mean, this went from April of 2020 to about September 2020. I've never made so much money for clients as we did with the gold and silver miners at that point. But you had to take profits, and we took huge profits at that point. We took profits earlier this year, but still, it's disappointing that they trade as inexpensively as they do. But frankly, when you compare the valuations of the gold miners to something, let's say, APA, the old Apache, APA is the symbol, they just use an acronym for their name now, but that's one that's got about a 25%, if not over 30% free cash flow yield. You don't find that with the gold miners. And that's, by the way, using estimated, the futures contracts for that. It's basically at about $75 oil and under $5 natural gas to create those estimates. So there's gold is... You know, again, I think in this day and age, with all the crazy stuff that's going on, whether it's geopolitically or monetarily, I think it's wise to have a position in gold and silver. But again, I think there's other areas that are more appealing.
Moving on to page 5, boy, the Fed is still expanding its balance sheet, even in the face of inflation. How long can that continue?
Well, they're trying to do QT right now, the inverse of QE. So QE is when the balance sheet expands. QT is when it contracts. As you can see, there's a little bit of a blue line below, but boy, they're certainly not moving at warp speed when it comes to shrinking the balance sheet. And what's absolutely incredible, one reason I included this chart, was as recently as March, the Fed was still printing money. Now, I say printing money, it's used loosely because it's not like the old Weimar Republic. They don't create, trillions and trillions of dollars of dollar bills. They create reserves, which digital reserves, which are used to buy treasuries to put them on their, or mortgage-backed securities, mostly treasuries, they put on their balance sheet. And what was really a, you know, kind of a head fake for a lot of folks was when they first did, the Fed first did QE1, QE2, QE3, and I would argue QE4 was the September 2019 intervention in the repo market where they started printing again $80 billion a month, and that's before COVID. But what really changed the game was that when COVID happened, instead of the Fed just printing, the government stepped up and was spending every bit as much money as the Fed was creating. So we ran about a $7 trillion deficit there for that post-COVID period, and the Fed bought most of that with their magical money machine. So it's, you know, all the, and that's, this is a, it relates to the economy. It's a very intense debate right now. As you know, are we going to have a recession? Are we in a recession? Because if the Atlanta Fed's number doesn't change, because as most listeners are aware, we've now had two negative quarters in a row from the Atlanta Fed on the economy, but it could be revised. And then you get people that are smart, and it's a good point. They'll say, hey, you can't have a recession when you've got negative real yields like we have. Where, yeah, the Fed funds rate's 2 3/8, but inflation's almost 7 full points above that. And by the way, as you know, Eric, that never happened even in the 1970s. As maligned as Arthur Burns was as the Fed chairman back in those days, he would get the Fed funds rate up to and even beyond the inflation rate fairly quickly. There were two big spikes, both caused by energy, and he lagged a little bit, but he at least got interest rates a little, you know, so if inflation was 9, he got to 10. And it wasn't huge, it wasn't Volcker-esque, but he got the Fed funds rate real. And a couple times, the 10-year treasury was 2.5% above inflation. Imagine if that happened today. We'd have an 11.5% 10-year treasury. And what are we today? 260, something like that. So, you know, there's the popular belief is that Jay Powell wants to become Paul Volcker. Well, before he becomes Paul Volcker, he better become Arthur Burns.
Well, the thing that's striking to me, David, about page 5 is, I mean, look at that just insane overstimulation that occurred because of the COVID pandemic. And then you see that they continue to expand their balance sheet. We get one itsy bitsy teeny weeny little bar that's showing actual quantitative tightening, like we're actually sucking in the balance sheet. And what is the hottest topic in finance discussed more than anything else right now? The coming Fed pivot and how long it's going to take before they reverse direction.
Right.
So, you know, we got one itsy bitsy little tick of contraction in the Fed's balance sheet, and a lot of people are complaining that they think the Fed has taken too long to pivot back to a more dovish stance. It doesn't seem to me that there's any realistic plan to ever actually, you know, normalize the balance sheet to what it was before the 2008 crisis. I don't think that ever happens.
I think you're right. I really doubt that. It's probably more likely that it's going to look more like the ECB's balance sheet and maybe eventually the Bank of Japan, which are, you know, much, much higher than where we are right now in terms of the Fed's balance sheet relative to the size of the economy. And if you wanted a visual of the negative real interest rates, just check out slide 6. I mean, it was really shocking. And you can see there's the 1970s on there and not even close. And again, kind of brief. And that's when Burns reacted and got interest rates up materially.
David, let's move on to the rest of the slide deck. Looking at slide 7, I haven't seen this chart before. What's going on here?
Well, it's pretty amazing that you would think more people would be agonizing about this. It basically shows that what happened in the first half of the year was the biggest wealth wipeout in financial market history, at least in the post-World War II period. Probably the 1930s were worse. So you had this triple whammy. You had a major stock market decline. You had the worst government bond market, according to Deutsche Bank, since 1788. Now, I've seen other ones going back to like 1917, something like that. It was an epic sell-off in bonds. And actually, I listened to your very, very well-done podcast with Harley Bassman, who's another one of my heroes. He probably knows the bond market better than anybody else. He invented the MOVE Index, which is the volatility index with the bond market. And he was saying, I think we're in an era where the typical correlation between stocks and bonds doesn't work anymore. We're moving into that. And I would say we've moved into it. Not to pun on his volatility index, but the point is that in the first half of the year, stocks went down, bonds typically go up. Instead, they got crushed. So he's right. I think it's a new era, but I think it's already begun. He was, you know, more saying this is what's going to happen. I think it's already happened. I think it's pretty hard to argue with that. So you would think the third part of the triple whammy was, of course, cryptos. And I think we should give ourselves a pat on the back about that, because you and I were both very negative on the cryptos last October when they were white hot, almost thermonuclear hot. And you look at what's happened with Dogecoin down 90%. And of course, the blowups in Terra and Voyage and Celsius, The one that hasn't happened yet, though, is Tether. You and I both thought something would the Tether would snap, but I continue to believe it's just a matter of time. And I think when it does, that we're going to have another down leg in the crypto world. And you might have seen they disclosed an $840 million loan to Celsius, which is, you know, bankrupt now. And they still haven't performed an audit. I don't know how hard it is to audit of money market securities, but they can't seem to come up with one. So anyway, just I think we can feel good about that. Where I think I was especially wrong was the dollar, because I did not think the dollar would continue to appreciate. And it's very odd with inflation surging, which is another thing that we both anticipated, that inflation was not transitory, and we were dead right. It did accelerate, but man, to have a dollar go up, the dollar go up the way it has with inflation, you know, on the warpath is very, very unusual. So as far as getting back to the market, if we went to slide 9, one of the things that I've noticed here lately is you've had a lot of bearish sentiment readings. If you look at the Michael Harnett bull bear thing, the bull reading is at 0. It's hard to get much lower than that. And yet, if you look at allocations, like household allocations, their high net worth universe that they track, very high allocations to equities. So what you basically have, I think, are a lot of fully invested bears. So I continue to think that the stock market's going through a bear market rally and that we're likely to see another down leg here before long. But maybe it's important to talk about things that are attractive. And, you know, obviously I've made the case for energy and for gold miners, but another area that has really gotten hit hard, though it's rallied a bit, are double B rated bonds. And you may have seen that Jeff Gundlach from Double Line was on CNBC last week saying that's an attractive area. We've been big buyers there, getting yields in the 6-8% range. And so that's, you know, that continues to be appealing. There's actually an ETF, ANGL, the Fallen Angel ETF. And within that is where a lot of the double B rated names reside. And a lot of those look to us like upgrade candidates. So there's been quite a bit of spread widening. So the difference between treasuries and corporates is expanded. So that's a good opportunity to buy corporate debt. So that's an area that looks pretty attractive. Another thing that I would say that, I wouldn't go short the dollar versus things like the euro or the yen, but I do think the next big play, or in fact, I'm going to write a piece on it about the next big short, is anti-dollar. I think the dollar is very extended, way too popular, way overvalued. I mean, we are a twin deficit country. Our huge federal deficits, our huge trade deficits, at some point that's going to catch up with us. The entitlements that are unfunded, at some point that's going to be a major drag on the dollar. But I would buy things that benefit from a weaker dollar, some of the things we've talked about, like copper, for example, and even the gold miners. Lastly, Harley Bassman, to give him another shout out, he was pointing out that the mortgage-backed securities market looks quite attractive at very wide spreads. And he also has talked bullishly about the mortgage REITs. There's one, AGNC, that's got an 11% yield, down about 30%, very conservatively run. And we also like emerging market debt, which has been crushed lately. And the yields are in the 10 to 11% range. And a lot of these funds are selling at double-digit discounts. So the point is, there's definitely places to put your capital, even if you share my negative view on the overall environment for now.
David, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us briefly, what do you do at Evergreen GavCal, and how can our listeners find out more about your work?
Well, believe it or not, we actually do research. As you can tell, we're definitely not indexers. We like to do individual security analysis, including of bonds, which is even more rare. But in addition to Evergreen GavCal's money management activities and research activities, I also have a Haymaker website, which is obviously a play on my name. And it's actually easy to access through Substack. And we do both a Friday version, which tends to be a little bit more macro, and then Making Hay Monday it tends to be market specific, you know, with specific trade recommendations and a couple of both an income and an equity portfolio that are tracked on a regular basis. Also, Eric, just real quickly, I did write, as you know, a book called Bubble 3.0, talking about how this is the third bubble, the biggest bubble of them all, the first being the tech bubble, the second being the housing, and they're all related. There was definitely a connection from 1, 2, and 3. And we got that out early this year because I was really of the belief that Bubble 3.0 was in the process of popping. Still believe that. I think that the evidence is pretty strong in that regard. We were particularly negative on the what I used to call the crazy overpriced stocks, which are not so crazy overpriced anymore. Many are down 70, 80, 90%. So anyway, that book is available now and online at Substack. And also there's an audio book out for people who like to listen to things while they're working out. But basically it's an indictment of the Fed, and that the Fed is really just let us down hugely over the last 20 years in this country. That's really kind of the basic theme.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a PodTrack certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have David on the show. You know, his perspectives on gold and silver were interesting. You know, I tend to be a little bit more bullish than his view, but anyway, that's just me. But I thought really what was interesting was the way he took away from that was the fact that we could have a global recession, but energy prices could rise during that environment. I was really interested in hearing you elaborate on that. What did you take away from it?
Well, I had previously made the same call. I thought that what was going to happen here is that you would see the flow of speculative open interest in crude oil futures come out of the market. We would see a big sell-off exactly as we've seen. I thought the 200-day moving average was probably the logical target. That's the target that we hit this morning. So my previous forecast was that's where it should all be over. We ought to be bottoming about here, and it should be all uphill from here as the market discovers exactly what David just said, which is, listen to what OPEC just told us. We're out of spare capacity. The world doesn't have enough spare capacity to increase production at all from where we already are. And that means it's not possible to return to pre-pandemic normal because there's not enough energy to supply the demand that existed in pre-pandemic normal. Surely that's got to carry energy prices higher. Well, guess what, Patrick? You know better than I do that one of the most important rules of trading is you can't let your own view about what you think should happen get in the way of paying attention to the market telling you what is happening. And what is happening here is, despite OPEC echoing the exact same view that David and I have been talking about, the world is out of spare capacity. Surely that should set the stage for prices to move higher. Well, guess what? We're selling off, and we're selling off hard on weakening economic data. And it's really important to remember, I have to remind myself, and maybe David does too, that unlike the stock market, which can be forward-looking and consider, hey, in the big picture of things, the world is out of spare capacity. This is an energy crisis. You know, the commodity markets don't work that way. They have to balance supply and demand in the here and now. In the here and now, demand is starting to collapse. Everybody knows that there's a recession coming. I think the recession will probably be longer lasting and deeper than most people expect. That suggests that the weakening demand expectations are probably overstated, and they're going to actually be weaker than that. So my revised outlook, Patrick, is there's plenty of room for oil prices to move considerably lower from here, with a really big caveat, which is if Vladimir Putin should ever decide that he wants to use withholding energy as a tactic of economic warfare, despite the weakening demand, Russia has the ability to intentionally pull oil off of the market for the purpose of forcing prices dramatically higher. They could still do that if they wanted to, and I think we have to be very alert to that possibility, but it's not what's happening right now. And as the market focuses on the here and now and the balancing of supply and demand, demand is weakening to the point where supply can keep up. And the fact that OPEC just told us they can't make any more supply if they tried, it's not relevant yet. It's going to be relevant someday. And when it becomes relevant, I say, watch out, because prices are going to the moon. But we could easily see $20 lower on price because of a deep recession before that starts to happen.
Well, you know, what's interesting is his comments on energy companies being a better opportunity. Obviously, many of these energy names went through a much deeper percentage drop than crude oil itself during this most recent pullback. And you could see why that's the case, because, I mean, in general, when the whole stock market is in a bear market and money is flowing out, then the correlation of all assets tends to go to one, and their equities are going to be hurt irrespective of that. But one of the interesting things that will happen here is that if energy prices stay low, crude oil, let's say under $90 for months, I'm curious whether or not that is going to pressure these energy stocks even further on the short term. Ultimately, that resolves itself in a very bullish way, but certainly it'll be really interesting to see whether this continues throughout the second half of the year.
Well, Patrick, I agree. And, you know, something I'd love to talk to you about, maybe we can do a post-game segment on it someday, is to think about how to use options in order to play this. Because on one hand, I do not want to be diving. You know, I thought maybe when we got down here to the 200-day moving average, that would be the time to back the leverage truck up and, you know, just buy long-dated crude oil futures hand over fist, expecting that huge move up that David was talking about, even in a recession. And frankly, as I've rethought that strategy, I don't want to do that, because I think we could see a lot more downside as demand continues to weaken in the coming recession. But hold on, there are these event risks, such as a further escalation of tension with Russia, or for that matter, now we've just kind of we poked the bear, now we've poked the dragon. Are we going to have a military escalation with China over this Nancy Pelosi visit? Seems like the market's not too worried about it. It's felt like a bigger deal to me than it seems to have felt like to most other people. If any of those things happen, you could see a very sudden move up in crude oil prices. Well, that's begging for maybe I ought to be, you know, buying deep out of the money calls on crude in order to take advantage of the potential for a sudden spike up in prices. Oh, but wait a minute. Super high volatility with, you know, yesterday we had a move up of $3 followed by a move down of $6 that you're paying through the nose for vol. So you can't just be buying calls here. You got to look at a more sophisticated strategy. I don't know if that's a ratio call spread or what the best way to play that is. Maybe we can do a post-game segment at some point in the future and talk about how to play this oil market for more sophisticated traders, because I got a feeling that some of your more nuanced option strategies would probably come into play here, but I haven't figured out exactly how to apply them. But we'll save that for a future episode. We're going to wrap it here for today's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the slides that David Hay shared with us, including links to a number of articles that we also found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.